You are listening to Radio Edgy Talk. This is John Johnson. I'm sitting in Glasgow, Scotland. And this is the second show after last night's of the new session of Radio Edgy Talk. We tend to run to school time. And I'm really delighted to have a kind of long-term friend of the show is the word I'm looking for. I'm going to say fan, Charlie. That's probably presuming too much. Friend of the show, Charlie Love. Charlie, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, John. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, and fan and friend. You can say both things. That's all good.
Thanks. Well, certainly, I've learned a lot from listening to Charlie and reading his blog for many years. And yet, I would say a very well kent person in Scottish and wider computing and ICT. Could you maybe just, for anybody that's not heard of you, Charlie, give us a, you know, who you are, where you've been, and that sort of thing, what you do now, that'd be great.
Yeah, okay, well, I'm currently an education support officer in Aberdeen, supporting schools across Aberdeen City in the use of digital technologies, which is a fantastic job, and it's a real privilege to work with a great number of schools and a great number of teachers, really professional teachers wanting to do fantastic work. So that's where I'm currently working. But my history, I was formerly a principal teacher of computing science in a number of schools in the northeast of Scotland. I've had a long history of working with SQA and Education Scotland, Learning and Teaching Scotland, before that on a variety of projects and developing qualifications. And also I was a part of the Derek Robertson's Consularium team in 2010-2011, working on games design and bringing that to Scotland's learners, which was a really exciting project. I've also been very much involved in GLOW and the development of the GLOW services. I was part of the ICT Excellence Group, which made certain recommendations to the Minister about where GLOW should go next, and many of those have come to fruition, which is wonderful to see. And I continue to be very much involved with that. I'm now co-chair of the Technical and Operational Advisory Group, which provides technical and operational guidance to the wider digital learning and teaching program in the Scottish Government. So I suppose that's a kind of very quick part of history, John, of where I've been and where I am now.
What you haven't done in ICT is probably a pretty short list, Charlie. It's great to have you on. Now, the sort of topic that we put in EduTalk is, and maybe touching one or two other things, you never know, is CFE technologies and the nation's need for digital skills. And I don't know which way you want to tackle it, but the nation's need for digital skills maybe points to what we need from technologies and CFE, but maybe just give us a wee starter on this anyway.
Well, we know in Scotland that we have a fantastic digital economy, a fantastic set of digital companies and digital services that have got worldwide renown, and we have a fantastic industry, but that industry is really struggling to get the right quality of right quality of people to fulfill their jobs that they have. So we have a real need for highly skilled programmers and digital creative people that can support this industry. And the Scotland IS, the sort of trade body in Scotland, have really identified that we need 10,000 people a year to fill the vacancies from retirements and people moving on and such. So we have a huge need for these digital people, and yet our platform to develop those skills at a school's level has kind of really shrunk. We've got our computing science departments in schools. A huge number of our schools, a large percentage, I think it's sort of 12, more than 12% of our schools across the whole of Scotland have no computing science in their school. There are no teachers there delivering computing science in those schools. We've seen a significant drop in the number of computing science teachers in the schools across Scotland, often moving from two people in a department down to one. And the changes in Curriculum for Excellence have actually led to less computing science being taught in the broad general education. And those things have all got a significant impact in terms of inspiring young people to get involved in digital skills and develop the digital skills, digital creativity, develop their programming and coding, and look at that as a possible career. And that's such a real challenge for us now, to adjust what we do in our schools to meet the need that there is out there in the industry, to ensure that we have a successful digital economy for Scotland.
So I'm just, as an aside, wondering why that's happened, you know, because since almost everybody engages with technology almost every day, you would think it would be very clear that we do need this, and it's just 10,000 jobs a year, and it's not 10,000, it's 10,000, I would imagine.
It's 10,000 every year.
Yeah, well-paid yeah. jobs and, good prospect-type jobs,
Absolutely. I mean, these are really promising careers for young people to get involved with. And we have seen some response to this. The Skills Development Scotland last year put together a ICT and digital skills investment plan with a number of strategies to get people into the industry. Much of that was focused on a kind of skills college, looking at the further education sector and how we could retrain the existing workforce out there to enter into the digital skills market. But it didn't have a large emphasis in terms of the schools-based input into developing digital skills. So one of the things that I'm very keen to explore, we've had Curriculum for Excellence now for, you know, five years now. We've had it in kind of from its first implementation, really. We've got Curriculum for Excellence in. We're moving forward with that. But technologies within Curriculum for Excellence, we probably need to look at that again, because I think the landscape has changed. The balance of time typically in a school will be that you might have, let's say you had four sessions of time dedicated to technologies in a week. Very often in a typical school, one of those will be for business education, one of those will be for computing science, and two of those periods would be for design and technology. When we look at the Curriculum for Excellence documents, there's a large emphasis on design and technology. There's a kind of equal weighting between business education and computing science. And my feeling is that we perhaps need to look again at that balance and say, where do we really need to invest to make sure that we're producing the right kind of, we're giving opportunities to develop the right kind of skills for Scotland moving forward. So although we do have a skill shortage in the construction industry, as well as a skill shortage in the computing science and the digital skills industries, where we need to start a discussion and debate about where do we go now? How do we look at our curriculum models and our curricular guidance through CFE to make sure that it's balanced in the correct way going forward?
So, I mean, I'm a primary school teacher, so I'm speaking from a depth of ignorance at the moment. There seems
not at all, John.
In secondary schools, there's maybe two drivers. You've got to, one, have the people to deliver the curriculum, but the other thing is that you've got to sort of entice the student body into your area. And I wonder, you know, does that need some effort as well? Do children who are interested in technology maybe need to realise that, or be shown, or it needs to be proved that this will help?
Well, I think we're seeing a great, you know, we are seeing a great resurgence and interest in computing science and coding as a extracurricular activity. We've seen the growth of things, we're seeing a growth of things like Coder Dojo, which is doing fantastic work about getting young people at a primary school level and in a broad general education, a kind of secondary school level, into computing science, into coding, into building and making things. We're seeing code clubs being developed across Scotland. There's a lot of development with that. In Aberdeen, we're going to be launching very shortly four separate code clubs in different schools across the city, so that's really exciting. And these essentially are an after-school club where young people come along and they take part in computing science activities, building programs, and sometimes they'll go on and build websites and do other digital activities as well. So that is growing. But in secondary, yes, there is a need to attract people into subject areas. But we've also, I think there's a big focus we need to focus more sharply in the broad general education, because we currently have, if you look at Curriculum for Excellence and the technologies there, when you look at computing science, it doesn't actually have an awful lot of computing science in it. Hmm. It's much more about context for learning. Build a computer game. Make something that's multimedia. And what I'm seeing when I'm working with schools is that much younger people than were intended to from the levels there. So level two activities can be completed by young people in kind of early level one, because the software and the applications have changed. We need to readdress what we do and make the computing science part of, in fact, we need to look again at the technologies and make the computing science part much more explicitly computing science. It needs to show a progression through sets of skills, and that isn't there currently in Curriculum for Excellence. There's lots of contexts about building a game, working collaboratively, and those are all strong and positive things, but then, you know, there's nothing about computational thinking. It was put together before that became a much more clear emphasis in terms of developing computing science education, and it's of its time, and we need to look at it again.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, one of the problems, I think, and certainly the primary, is that an awful lot of that can be sort of addressed by make a PowerPoint type activities where children just do the same sort of activity, which is using technology, but it certainly doesn't touch on any computational thinking at all. And I wonder, the way England is going about this at the moment, do you see that as a way forward, or what do you think about that?
I think what England has done is, I think it's very interesting. I think there's a danger with what they've done is that they've made it overly prescriptive. It's extremely prescriptive, the English curriculum. It introduces quite complex language and concepts at a very, very young age. I was concerned when the English curriculum was put together that it seemed to me, as a computing, someone with a long history in computing science, that it was a curriculum put together without a real understanding of how to engage young people in particular elements of developing computer science learning. So it spoke about algorithms and developing understanding algorithms. But really what we're wanting to do is enthuse young people about creating a program that has some very simple constructs in it to begin with, and then those constructs getting gradually more complex, but not necessarily having to frighten off young people by talking about algorithms and parameters and things very early on. Although that is the language of computing, you still want to focus on the enthusiasm and the creativity of the subject.
And I think there's probably very few people who have come into computing traditionally, who started their interest by knowing what an algorithm was. They probably started with picking up something that made something.
Let's do some
magic here. Let's type these words, and a skull appears on the screen. Yay!
my way into computing, and the way that I've seen many people come into it, is that let's try and build some cool stuff. Mm. Let's try and find out code. Discover what we can make and build with code. I do a lot of work with young learners P3, P4, P5 on using Scratch in school and allowing. So essentially, when I do that kind of activity, I do a very quick sort of lesson start to frame how it works, demonstrate how the blocks go together, how you can create different programs using this block-based language. And then I very much hand that over to the learners to allow them to be as creative as they want, and then to support them through that process. And it's all about, the creativity is a really important part of learning to code and create. But you can then use that, once you've got that passion for building, you can then use that to introduce how does, you know, what is an algorithm? An algorithm just has a list of steps. You've already done that when you made your program. What is a parameter? Well, that's already something that you've used to tell that block over there that that something is collided with something else on the screen. So there's, you can use the context from the language to introduce the concepts.
Yeah, and I think that it's certainly a much more attractive way to learn these things, or to get excited or interested. I was just reading a blog post by a programmer today on the way home on the train. His point was he had been at some sort of startup farm or something in America where they had been doing things, and this is way back in, I think, the Apple II days, and they had to write a wee bit of code, and he did something that moved colours and blocks around the screen. And they said the next guy up had done this fantastic thing with, you know, flames and skulls and dripping blood. That was just amazing. And then he looked at his code, and he had actually coded this whole graphic thing pixel by pixel in a straightforward writing a line of code for every pixel on the screen. So it was really terrible from a programmer's point of view, but delightful from the audience's point of view,
Yeah, absolutely. And we do have to write efficient code. I mean, that's something you learn as you go through that process.
Where do you start? Do you start with, say, learning the theory, or do you start with fun?
I always believe you've got to start with fun to make something engaging. If you enthuse young people around computing, about computing science, they will want to learn more. They will want to learn the skills around creating a piece of software. And then from that, those young people will want to learn, well, how do I improve that software? How do I make it better? Where do I get examples of other people's code so that I can relate to that and use part of that? Where do I find module libraries to integrate in my code? And then the young people would then to find out that they will need some set of tools to help them plan and manage that process. And you can bring in other aspects of computing science when that comes out, when you come to that. So you can do this very much from that point of view of engaging young people and developing and allowing them to develop through a path, through a curriculum pathway, but you've got to focus on the fun for it. And we very much, computing science departments across Scotland are actually pretty good at doing this, but what they're facing is they're very much facing a reduced time allocation to engage young people in the subject, and that's one of the blockers, one of the barriers that a number of computing science departments are facing, is they just don't have enough time with the young people in front of them to develop that enthusiasm and those skills.
I guess as well in a secondary school, one of your main drivers is once you get up a bit is exams, and it may be quicker just to go for the more boring approach than it is to develop something creative. I mean, I don't know. I'm just.
I mean, I think Curriculum for Excellence is fantastic in the what we set out to do with Curriculum for Excellence was to establish that there was this entitlement to a broad general education, that every young person would have a set of experiences and outcomes that would give them this broad base from which they could then move into their individual specialisms. And that's, to me, that's absolutely the right way to go. However, what we've got to understand is, and I was part of the qualification design team for the new national qualifications from National 3 and upwards. And what we have to understand is that those qualifications are predicated on that broad general education. So if young people aren't getting their entitlements in school, they're not getting their computing science allocation of time, they're not getting taught by a computing science teacher, and then those young people decide that they're going to follow a computing science course, they will potentially be at a disadvantage, because they won't have covered that baseline of work that then takes them into those new qualifications. So we have to be very careful around what are young people's what their entitlements are in school and that they're getting enough engagement with a broad general education. But I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's time now for us to look at the broad general education, particularly in the technologies, and say, have we got the balance right here? Do we need to change where subjects appear? For example, in England, computing science isn't a technology subject, it's a science subject. It sits there with physics and chemistry and biology. It's a science subject for the English baccalaureate.
So, yeah, that's quite interesting, because what came to mind before you got to that point was, if you take technologies as a whole and you think about the creative approach, I was wondering, is it that you could sort of engender a creative approach to different aspects of technology, or even art and all sorts of things right across the curriculum, that would help with basically problem solving, which I think a lot of computing science is to some extent about, and a lot of these other things are about. And is there sort of general guidance for ideas that run across curricular areas or across the whole of technologies around, you know, a general understanding of creativity?
Well, I think there's some great scope there. I mean, that many of the kind of elective courses that the schools have in the broad general education could be around digital creativity. They could be bringing the arts together. I mean, it's very, you know, the arts with the sciences, the technologies, and education, engineering and maths, that STEM, kind of that STEAM approach is really strong, because it embeds everything together, it brings that creativity into. I'm a huge fan of that. Many of the kind of elective subjects, the kind of cross-curricular working, we would call it, that has some huge opportunities for bringing the creativity and computing science together. Yeah.
I wonder if there's also the way that, you know, you approach, you're talking about approaching scratch in a very open-ended way, so the children are driving that, and again, that could be applied in other areas of technology, in other areas of science, in other areas of art, where the children would drive that, and they would discover techniques that will work across the different areas, that simple problem-solving techniques like try something, check it, try again. That's it. There's more appropriate ones, but that's the one I always use.
Well, that's a fantastic technique. What you've described there is what we call iterative prototyping, and it's an agile development technique. It's a very valid computing science concept. It's something that's actually now in the new higher computing science as one of the techniques that young people need to know about as part of that qualification. So, you know, try it, do it again, check it and test it. It sounds like, you know, that's a very short way of putting it, but there is there's a whole methodology around computing science coding that uses that approach. So it is really, really valid. But there are a number of techniques that naturally come out of learning to code, learning to program, learning to be, you know, that kind of creativity. So we were mentioning Scratch there. I mean, Scratch is a fantastic piece of software that I've used an awful lot in schools. One of the things I was hoping we might get a chance to chat about tonight was Minecraft.
I was hoping, because I saw, I think, a blog post or two by yourself from, was it MindCon or something like that? I don't know the name of the conference in London.
I went along to what's called MindCon.
Yes.
So MindCon is the worldwide Minecraft conference, and it's a bit of an event. I hadn't quite appreciated how much of an event it was. So it was 10,000 people in the Excel Centre in London. The tickets quite literally sold out in about 3 minutes online. Wow. And I have two huge little Minecraft fans at home. I have two boys that are very, very keen on Minecraft, and they'd been at me for about a year saying we would love to go to Minecon. And I heard that Minecon was going to be in London, so I thought, okay, well, I'm interested in Minecraft. I think it's got huge possibilities both for learning. It's a fantastic game for just for playing. And I thought, yeah, I quite fancy going to that. So I went along to the conference. I got tickets and I went with my two boys, and my dear wife came with us, which was she enjoyed herself as well, I have to say. So we all went along to this Minecraft conference, and it was quite an amazing event. I've never been to a kind of gamer conference before. And what I experienced at that Minecon was just unbelievable. People of all ages, but obviously a significant number of young people there to show their affection and their love of the game. The whole buzz about the place was so absolutely positive. And one of the things I was really fortunate to take part in, there were a number of Minecraft in education workshops and sessions there. And I went along to these just to see, you know, how is Minecraft being used? And I bumped into Derek Robertson, mm-hmm. Formerly the Consularium, who's now at Dundee University. And I'll mention maybe in a wee bit some of the work that Derek's been doing. But at the Minecraft conference, we got to see some great work where schools had used Minecraft as a creative environment, particularly for team building, allowing young people to be creative, to use it to develop numeracy concepts, so volume and doing calculations on distance and mass, and using it in a science context to create physics experiments with blocks moving and creating machines with pistons, and huge potential for learning, and we saw some fantastic examples of that, and also to address kind of moral questions as well. So, for example, in Minecraft, you can set up a server, and then all of your children can come into that server. They can use things like TNT to blow holes in the ground. Now, sometimes that's, you know, sometimes there's a really positive reasons for doing that. If you put TNT into your Minecraft world, you might want to blow a hole in the ground so you can get into caves and explore the area underneath the ground. So it's a quick way of getting into that space. But equally, you can use TNT to blow up what people have built in the world. So there's a whole set of moral questions around: will we let Minecraft on our server? Will we allow that? Is it only some people get to use it? Who gets to use it? How do we decide which people use it? So there's lots of discussions that can be had around those kind of ideas. But Minecraft is this wonderfully wonderful creative space that young people seem to gravitate to. They are creative in that space. They're able to have interactions with people in a positive way. And it seemed, what I've seen with my own children, but also through this conference, has been, you know, incredibly positive. I was reading just the other day a fantastic piece of work about how Minecraft had autistic children that had been using Minecraft had used it in a way to start to have engagement with others in a really positive way. So it took away the some of the issues that young people have around face-to-face interactions, and their interactions through Minecraft with others were positive, and that developed confidence in them. So I think it's got Minecraft itself has got huge potential for learning, and particularly, you know, you've seen some of the work that's been done in Northern Ireland, where I think 200 schools now have Minecraft and are building Minecraft worlds and using it to explore their own creations and model, you know, using it for history lessons to model architecture, a whole range of different things. And also Derek Robertson's project down at in Dundee, he's been doing a fantastic piece of work with Minecraft, modeling the waterfront in Dundee for the new V&A museum that's going there on the waterfront. And young people have been modelling what would they like the waterfront in Dundee to look like. They've been building their own creations, and it's just been amazing to see. There was an article in Tez, I think it was, or a Scotsman, a few months ago about that. So it's fantastic stuff.
I'm hoping that Derek's going to come on and tell us a bit more about that in a future show. A couple of things struck me. I mean, this idea of the moral decisions, I saw a really interesting project, and of course I haven't got the URL, I remember where I saw it, but it was an American high school where the decisions on the server about who could do what and, you know, who could have TNT and stuff was done by a group of pupils as opposed to, you know, the teachers. So they'd actually turned that over, you know, whether you could have different features on the server that were controlled by the pupils. So I thought that was a really great way forward, especially given that my shots of Minecraft have always ended in complete failure to build anything like, and so BCT me. I think having the kids in charge would be a good idea in this case.
Well, I think having kids in charge is a great idea in terms of running your Minecraft server and involving young people in setting up that digital environment. Because beyond the server, you know, beyond the playing the game, there's setting up the variables, the spawn points, the coordinates in the game, this whole heap of things. I mean, one of my 10-year-olds came home from Minecon and he set up his own server when he came home. Yeah. Downloaded the files, he set it up, he watched some YouTube videos about how to build this environment and get spawn points so you could have two teams of players that could choose which team they were going to go on to, and he chose a red team and a blue team, and then he created this environment where he and a few of his friends could set up, come into this and play Minecraft with each other. It was fantastic to see, and really just, you know, I was blown away by it. And all of that off his own bat, you know, he just wanted to take, you know, have some interaction in that space and thought, that right, I'm going to do this.
And another interesting thing I was talking to Derek about, and it kind of links to something that I alluded to yesterday or earlier today, earlier this evening even, is that before Derek went to the conference, he's a bit worried about the educational effort in the Minecraft being too prescriptive. And he came away very reassured, I think, that there was plenty of scope for leaving it open-ended, which kind of alludes back to the where do the kids go with scratch? How do you engender creativity? You know, do you need to have an endpoint when you're starting something to become, you know, creative and to make something?
Well, I think what you need to do, you need to have an idea of what you want to build, or a sort of direction that you want to move in with what you want to build, and then you need somebody to shape that, to give you advice around how to approach that in the best way. And with Minecraft, that can come from a variety of sources. So it can come from the online experience and the online community. It can come from, you know, the videos and such that are there. But also, I mean, it could come from the teacher, and the teacher could in the class could actually have some skill and knowledge of Minecraft and how that can be used. And it can come from the peers in the classroom. So there's a number of sources for information around how to do something in Minecraft. And I think if you've got access to that community, access to your peers, and you've got an idea of what you want to build and make, then you can find out how to make a redstone circuit. You can find out how to make a piston. You can discover how to make, you know, flushing toilets. You know, these are all things that you can work out how to do this. But one of the things that we have to accept is if we use digital tools like Minecraft for learning. I've just noticed I've just got a DM here from Jim McLean, and who works in Aberdeenshire, and Jim's one of their ICT folk there. He makes a really good point in this, that he messaged to me. He says it's really important that if we've got Minecraft and we've got these digital tools, that our teachers feel empowered to accept the evidence that those environments generate as evidence of learning.
That's
building something Yeah, building something in Minecraft, making that digital artifact. If you construct a model of, let's say, you know, the Leaning Tower of Pisa in Minecraft, you know, with its flushing toilet, whatever, and you build that, that's evidence, and your teacher can view that just as well as if you'd done it in, made a model in plasticine or Lego or clay, or you've done it with wood and matchsticks or whatever. If that was part, or you've done it with paper, that digital artifact, our teachers need to feel empowered that they can use those digital environments, and that is valid evidence. And ideally, they got some way to reference it, whether it's taking screenshots, photographs, making video. There's some way that they can evidence that to retain that for as a record of learning.
So that was really good, because I thought it was going to go a strange way at the start of the quote. I thought it was going to go to, you know, teachers need to be able to use Minecraft. I mean, I've only seen a few people use it in the classroom and generally on iPads. And what impressed me most was the teachers who basically allowed, you know, the children were working on a topic and they were building stuff in Minecraft to go with that topic. But the teacher had no particular knowledge of Minecraft. So it was the children, but she was confident enough to let them work away and evaluate the evidence afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what we need to have. I mean, for me, we need to have it would be great if we as a nation had a set of Minecraft servers that were secure, that could be accessed through a secure login, that were set up in a way that allowed creativity, but also took away some of the technical overhead for teachers in terms of setting up Minecraft for learning. So, I mean, it'd be great if we had that. You know, if you could log into something like Glow and get into a Minecraft server, that would be an awesome thing. That would just be brilliant, wouldn't it?
Oh, it would be just wonderful. Yeah, I think that's a really good. And there's a few things that seem that they would need a bit of national effort to get spread.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know how long you got, John. I always aim for half an hour, the thing I'm interested in is that some of the technologies. I think that, you know, why should we do something nationally? And it's maybe to something like yourself could probably set up a Minecraft server in a school, work around any problems they had to get it going, get all the kids on, you know, do something like that. But other people can't. And it kind of, by doing something nationally, you maybe sort of spread the load, but also spread the opportunity.
Well, I think spread the load, spread the opportunity, and also share the good practice. I mean, we had I suppose when I think back to kind of 2009, 2010, 2011, we had in Scotland, we were hugely ahead of the game, internationally renowned as a place where digital learning and games-based learning and games design were world leading in that area. And I think this is an opportunity for us to say as a nation, right, we're going to, you know, come again, look at what we do with our digital tools, where we are in terms of using games-based learning again, where we are in terms of supporting the development of digital technologies, and we could actually have a fantastic digital ecosystem for learning in Scotland. We have everything that we need to make that happen. We could have tools like Minecraft. We could have a whole range of examples of practice with using these environments shared through our education portals. We could generate a fantastic community around this kind of games-based learning, games design, and use of these digital spaces. It would be absolutely brilliant.
I don't know if you want to talk about, because you were involved, but the sort of importance of the consortium in that. I probably mangled the pronunciation as usual. But it was quite a small team. But I say you've got this international buzz going, and that surely is worth an effort to get back again, I would have thought.
Well, I think what the legacy of that team is, you know, I think is still very strong in that many people, you know, have taken the practice to a whole, you know, it proved that games could be used and commercial games could very much be used as that, you know, I'm quoting Derek Robertson here, but it's that contextual hub. Mm-hmm. It's got cultural relevance for the children, it's valid, but yet there's so much learning involved in using those particular applications. So using, you know, Dr. Karashima's maths, the brain training things, work, the research that was published that Derek did there with David Miller at Dundee Uni, all around how you can improve mental maths ability by using maths games every morning for 30 minutes. And you could show demonstrated an improvement in mental maths ability and the ability of young people to do 20 mathematical sums in their heads. And that you know, that was a huge contribution to this, providing the evidence that actually learning with games is positive. And also the research they did around Nintendogs and the sort of health and well-being outcomes for very young children using Nintendogs to care for an animal, experiencing that range of emotions and developing their health and well-being experiences and outcomes from that approach. That's all very positive research as well. So there's lots of work that was done, but the Consilarium was a fantastic group of people who very much under Derek's leadership developed case studies and examples of practice which were shared online through the Learning Teaching Scotland, then the Education Scotland blogs, and there was a vast sort of body of evidence there about great work that had real impact in terms of attracting young people to technologies and supporting digital learning and teaching.
And that kind of leads on to another question, because we're both saying that, you know, we think that Minecraft is a good idea, and it certainly looks as if it is. And I mentioned earlier, I saw on Stephen Downes's blog today about Second Life, which was greatly adopted by universities. I don't know how many people ever actually get into it, but they set up spaces in this virtual world. And the some of them are still selling hundreds of pounds a month for the services. And this guy then somebody went a tour through the point of this post is like a tour through the wastelands of what Second Life has become. It's called the post called "We Took a Tour of the Abandoned College Campuses of Second Life," you know, and it's sent back in 2007. Now, with hindsight, I think we could say that, you know, that we weren't ready for it. I don't know if the technology was ready for it. Certainly, our networks weren't. Our hardware maybe wasn't. And I don't know if people culturally were. And I would say if you compared Minecraft now, one of the things I think is it runs on fairly low hardware. The children are ready for it and culturally aware, so you can see that's would seem to have a better chance of doing things. But I wonder about this idea of selecting technologies, because we see so many bits of educational technology come and go, and you've got to bet on them and you've got to pay money for them. And I wondered if you had any insights on how you would do that.
Yeah, that's a tough question, because if you look at something like Minecraft, you possibly wouldn't have bet too much money on it. Because it's this blocky experience. The early versions were pretty low resolution, but that's a tough question. Sometimes you do need to take a punt on technologies. I suppose I've always been very pragmatic about how I approach technology, in that I look for things that genuinely do work, that they are elegant and they are simple. If something is overly complex, if it requires a large, you know, a very large effort to set up, it's going to be difficult to roll out to scale, and it's going to be difficult to get widespread adoption. So you have to choose tools that are simple, straightforward, elegant, and that your target user group can pick up and engage with. That's why I love things like WordPress. because if you have a WordPress blog, like the WordPress blogs that are in Glow, you can go into that blog, you can do a couple of clicks, and your blog is now available. It's absolutely fantastic. So you know that's a classic example of something that's very simple. You log on, you do a couple of clicks, and there's your environment. You're ready to start blogging. You're ready to start sharing your learning, and keeping, whether that's for your e-portfolio or whatever, you're ready to do that because it's simple. And the WordPress platform is going from strength to strength because it fundamentally focuses on keeping it simple and being effective for the user. Mm-hmm. So it's, you have to pick technologies that are going to absolutely, they're going to be simple, they're going to work. If they're overly complex, if it takes too long for you to set up, if you've got to do a whole heap of stuff to get to prepare something for people to come into it, then they're probably not going to use it. And that's probably why you find something like Second Life now is kind of fallen by the wayside, because you had to build... You had to build all these complicated spaces. You had to write a heap of code to do interesting, exciting things in the environment. But it went beyond. You had to do that to get the function. With something like Minecraft, you can pick it up and you can use it, and you can do nothing. You can just use the game as it is, the raw game, and just use that. So I think that's maybe the difference between. The difference between sort of Minecraft and Second Life, and probably the difference between our successful learning technologies and the ones that fall by the wayside. If they are too complex, if there's too many things to do, they won't get that widespread adoption.
I wonder if you'd agree. I tend to feel as well that the more open-ended something is. Now, obviously, Second Life was very open-ended, and that this argument falls over that one like a first fence. But, you know, if the technology is simple to use but open-ended, we don't know what people are going to do with them. I'm sure when you were down at Minecon, you saw things that you thought, oh, why would somebody do that? And, you know, that's interesting. And certainly with blogs, I'm continually surprised at what people do. And I think that combination of, you know, ease of use, ease of getting going, and... Well, we don't really know what it's for. it's useful. I mean, you know, some things are for, obviously, but being open to that, and I think this ties back to the creativity, being open to serendipitous things that come up.
Yeah. I mean, if you've got tools that let you do an oddball things, I mean, I suppose I come back to things like. WordPress, well, you can set up WordPress to just be a blog, you can set it up to be a website, you can set up to be a record for all your photographs, you can use it a whole variety of ways, but essentially the function of the tool is you know, relatively straightforward and relatively easy to access, and it is relatively open-ended. You can just go in there and you can do what you want, and much of our technology, you know, much of the technology we've had, you know, I think 10 years ago, if you wanted to go online and do something digitally, it was cumbersome. You had to do HTML and all that kind of stuff. So we've definitely got better in terms of having sort of higher quality digital tools that are more accessible.
Great. Well, I think that's as good an answer to that question as we're going to get. I wish I'd written it down because I could ask everybody that, because it's a hard one, I think. Stuff rolls along. What do you pick?
I mean, one of the things I do sort of frequently have to pick up and look at different pieces of technology, and I always look at them in that way. Is it simple? Is it straightforward? Can, you know, in my particular role just now, can a teacher who has a huge number of demands in their time, they're professional people, they're very committed, they've got stacks of things to do, Is a particular piece of digital technology going to improve their lot? Is it going to make their life easier? Is it going to add value to the work that they do? Or is it going to become a cumbersome distraction, something that isn't going to help them or their learners? So I always try and look at technology in that way. Is it going to add value? Is it going to help? Is it going to improve their lot? Is it going to increase engagement? Or is it going to detract from that?
Brilliant. That's actually a great check. I'm kind of conscious of time. I don't know if there's anything else you want to touch on before we hang up the broadcast.
I think that's been a, it's been a really great chat, John. I'm very really glad you had me on. I wanted to say just a few things about CFE, and hopefully I've done that in a reasonably coherent manner. And we have, you know, we have a great opportunity, I think, with digital technologies. Education Scotland published their technologies impact review, and that was a welcome document that spoke about the, across the technologies, about how important creativity was for our technologies. I'm really excited to see that in the latest inspection notice from HMIE, they've got some coverage and they're talking about GLOW and about digital technologies and using those for learning, and there'll be, the inspectors will be looking for that when they come and visit our schools, and I really welcome that. And what I'm very much hoping is that when we get to the point of the next version of How Good Is Our School, when we look at the measures that we have put in place, that we look for in our schools, that we have something in there that very much looks at technologies, the importance of technologies, and hopefully, in my mind, the importance of digital technologies to support learning.
Brilliant. Yeah, I don't think anybody could argue with that, and we'll look forward to that. So, thank you, Charlie. If you're listening live, this is only the first job of the academic year I've done. We've got plenty more shows lined up. You can see them at edutalk.cc. You can always tweet at us if you're interested in the show using the hashtag edutalk. Or tweet at EdgyTalker, or myself at John Johnson. And Charlie is at Charlie_Love.
Yeah, that's right.
And the other thing is that if you have some interesting thing you'd like to talk about technology, or, sorry, about education, I'm just a bit hyped with technology tonight, Charlie, but if you're interested in talking about any aspect of education, please feel free to get in touch and invite yourself onto the show, or suggest a topic or idea. And that's all for me to say is thanks very much, Charlie. It's always a delight and exciting to talk to you. And we'll be seeing you, folks. Cheers.